the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. By now, we've all heard about the poor working conditions Amazon workers face globally. So why then are there only two unionized Amazon factories in North America? This week on Rabble Radio, labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga talks to Felix Trudeau, the president of the first union to be certified at an Amazon warehouse in Canada. The two discuss his efforts unionizing his colleagues and what other Canadian workers can learn from their experiences. A bit about our guest. Felix Trudeau's union was created in May 2024 and is a part of the Confederation of National Trade Unions, the second largest trade union federation in Quebec. Trudeau and his colleagues have entered their first round of collective bargaining with Amazon. Members continue to mobilize to secure the first collective agreement in the history of the multinational. Here are Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Felix Trudeau in conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Felix. Just to get started, can you, as much as you can tell me, give a bit of detail about the journey to certification for the union at the Laval Amazon warehouse?
Of course. Thank you for having me. So I think the unionization effort really starts from the same place that I imagine all unionization efforts at Amazon will start from. When you work at Amazon, there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of problems at the job, you know, at work. And they are, as far as I understand it, very common across the different, like, Amazon warehouses, you know. Like, an obvious one is low pay. Like, it's a very glaring issue that people, like, feel very vividly because we work hard and we make this company a lot of money. And yet we're paid low wages. That's the first issue. But then there's the work conditions themselves. You know, the work is fast paced. There's a lot of like injuries. There's a lot of risks. Amazon is a company where they very often make changes to work conditions. They introduce new machines. They introduce new processes, new ways of doing things. And almost always these new work conditions, they worsen our quality of life at Amazon, or they just make the work more complicated for the workers. It's a company where there's a lot of arbitrary decisions that are made, and they are not made with the input from workers. They're not made with worker well-being in mind. They are made with profit in mind, above all else. And so what you have is a workplace with its own problems. That's any workplace, but they're very glaring at Amazon, those problems, because they take on a scale that's unusually large. It's a big company. It employs a lot of people. And those problems just, you know, multiply as time goes on and as Amazon makes new decisions. So to go back to your initial question, my colleagues and I, we had problems. We wanted to solve them. And really, the union is the best tool we have to solve those problems. Because when you have a big multinational like Amazon, what you need to solve these kinds of problems is leverage. You need to have an organization that will give workers a voice, but that will give workers power over their own conditions. And alone and divided, it's very hard to change your work conditions on that level. Like I could have gone to management and asked for I want 26 an hour right now, and they would have said, oh, thank you for your feedback, we'll escalate this. That's not, individually you can't solve problems of that magnitude for a multinational like that. What you need is strength, and that's where the union comes in. So we realized there were problems, we realized that the way to fix this was together. And the union seemed like the most viable and efficient way to solve those problems together.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, you're talking about all these stories that come out of Amazon warehouses, and I know in the media we see them as well. Some pretty crazy stories about breaks, about pay, all these issues that come up at Amazon. And so I'm wondering, given these work conditions, why do you think it is that there are only two warehouses in Canada and America that are unionized right now? What are some of the obstacles or barriers to unionizing at Amazon?
Amazon has its reputation regarding unions. Obviously, it's weird to even qualify their position regarding unions because, in one way, you could say they claim to be neutral, but they explicitly say, "Oh, we're not neutral about this." But they don't want to say they're against this. But all this to say, obviously, Amazon doesn't want unions in their warehouses, and they take steps to try and prevent that from happening. We can see, first and foremost, there's legal challenges to union efforts that will be made. When there's a vote, for example, in one warehouse, they'll contest the validity of the vote. When there's no vote, they'll contest the card check. That's the first aspect. There's Amazon's attitude. But then I think with all major unionization efforts in history, there probably was a time for all those big factories that got unionized where people were like, well, why are there so few unions? But a unionization process is a process. And we're at the start, I think, of a larger wave Amazon unionization. There's obvious interest in that question from workers. The basis for for unionization is there, and there is increasing interest from the labor movement on that question. So I think, with regards to why there's only two unionized warehouses in North America right now, I think I'd say there's only two for now. And I don't think it's going to stay at two for very long.
As we talk about then the future of unionizing Amazon warehouses, like you said, there's only two unionized warehouses for now. Can you tell me a bit about some of the obstacles you encountered while unionizing the warehouse and how, what kind of work it took to overcome them?
Generally speaking, I think concrete obstacles to like a unionization process, I think you'll find it resembles other unionization campaigns. The big question is always like, will it work? And like, is there any risk to my job? Because no one wants to get fired. What you need to do to succeed a unionization effort, you need to make your case that yes, the union has a good chance of actually doing what we needed to do, like actually solving those work condition problems, increasing the salary, all that stuff. Like the case has to be convincing, and you need to actually do the work of you actually you need to do the work necessary to deliver afterwards. Like you need to have people that are committed to the union effort to not only drive the unionization campaign, but after that are willing to commit to the whole negotiation phase and the organizing of the union once it's created, once it's legally created. But that's the first thing. And then on the question of people being scared to lose their jobs, because that's the crux of it, right? Like whether or not that fear is exaggerated, because like on the one hand, yes, you've had like union leaders that have faced like, repercussions for organizing at Amazon. But on the other hand, there's, many hundreds of people in North America that have, joined a union at Amazon and that have not had those kinds of consequences. All this to say, when you want to succeed at the unionization campaign and people, are scared for their jobs, you need to be able to build trust. Not only do you need to build a connection with people and have a good understanding of everyone's situations, their worries, their aspirations, you also need to be able to provide some, backing. You need to be able to tell people, look, they can't fire you. It's illegal for them to fire you for the union. Signing a union card will be confidential. You need to be able to explain like the legal protections, but and this is where having the backing of a an established union comes in. It's you need to be able to tell people, look, like we're in this together, but it's not just like the few of us, like the labor movement is there if there's an issue. So there are some obstacles to unionizing Amazon, of course, but like when you get down to it, it really comes down to do people want to commit themselves to changing their work conditions? Do they want to commit to a collective project? And if so, if they want to do that, do you have the trust of your colleagues, to back them and to do this all together? And I would honestly say to Amazon employees, like to Amazon workers in North America, if they're listening, like trust your colleagues, like talk to them about your problems. And I am very certain that support for union efforts are far more widespread than we might think.
Yeah, I really like that. You kind of touched on this idea of collective power and how the labor movement more broadly has been able to support with that. I'm curious, can you tell me more about what the labor movement in Canada at least has done to support your union as you guys were working to get certified and now that the warehouse is unionized?
Yeah, I was kind of being romantic there with the whole labor movement. Like, I think if we ask the whole labor movement to help, I think there's ways to do that. But in this specific case, I'm talking about the specific union federation we're working with, we're affiliated to. Okay, I'll give you an example because it's a very striking story. When a majority of workers at my warehouse decided to join the union, we filed for union recognition. And I don't know, like, I don't want to get too deep into the details, but in Quebec, if you have a simple majority of workers that sign a card, a union card, you get like an automatic certification. It's not the case in Ontario, but in Quebec, that's the way it is. So after we did that, after we submitted the majority of cards, Amazon's reaction was to contest the constitutionality of the Quebec Labor Code. Their lawyers submitted a complaint to to the labor tribunal to say this automatic card check goes against freedom of association according to the Canadian Constitution, which is, first of all, wild. That an American company would dare to come to Quebec and, tell us that our labor code that has existed for decades is not constitutional. Just that is wild. But then it's like that is a tough legal question. Like, I don't have a handle on that. My colleagues don't have a handle on that. But with that question, we had the support of, the union, like a legal, department, like experienced labor lawyers that knew how to handle this type of stuff. So more generally speaking, there's the whole legal question of labor relations because right now in Canada, like labor relations are very legalized. It's very judicial. Like there's a lot there's a labor code you have to there's articles you have to understand, there's so there's jurisprudence you have to know, like blah blah blah, like there's the whole legal aspect. But then it's like to for a union effort to succeed beyond that, what you need is people with experience and boots on the ground, like people to canvas, to help do some calls, help have meetings, stuff like that. And CSN, the union we're affiliated to, provided that kind of help, that kind of support. So there's specialized support, like legal, that type of stuff. But there's also, just the activist side, the people that will be there to, help you along with the whole meat of the work there.
Yeah, for sure. And that's I like that you bring up the activist side as well, because obviously it's important that workers, stand up for their rights, but the workers are safer when there's a broad mass movement supporting them. So I'm curious, what can supporters do? People, who are hearing about this, who want to see more than just two Amazon warehouses unionized, what can they do to support you and your work and, Amazon workers in general?
Yeah, well, it depends where you are, of course. If you're in Quebec, for sure, I'd say, if you know anyone that works at Amazon and an Amazon warehouse, you should definitely, relay them like the information you see on the news or whatever about what's going on with the union, the different events, stuff like that. And yeah, if you're in Quebec, I would say and you don't work at Amazon, but you support the whole effort, then I'd say pay attention. We might need your help in the next few months. We'll see how it goes. But if you're elsewhere, well, it depends. I know if you're in Toronto, if you're in Ontario, come into contact with the folks at Amazon Worker Solidarity. Grassroots groups like that can help with putting people into contact and putting more activist resources towards this larger project. So I would say, definitely if you're in Toronto and you're interested in helping out union organizing for Amazon, reach out to Amazon workers if you know any. But other than that, if you want to help with a more community organizing aspect, if you want to help, organize this large coalition of people who want to organize Amazon, you should definitely check out Amazon Worker Solidarity. If you're outside of Quebec or Toronto, investigate, what's going on around you. If there's any active campaign, there's any union even that's accepting or requesting outside activist help. And it might seem a bit indirect, but I'd say also if you want to help Amazon workers to unionize, if you're in a union, make your union strong, make your union combative, work towards a combative and energetic labor movement, because that's what all of us need in any case. That's what all of us workers need. So we'll help each other that way too.
So that's our time for today. Thank you again so much for joining us on Ravel Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Felix Trudeau alongside Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Felix and Gabby. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. To take us there, let's pass it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Nick, over to you.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting with labor news, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers is preparing for strike action this week. At issue are wages and benefits for rural and urban postal carriers. However, the union is raising the alarm against the increasingly anti-worker posture of the federal government. On multiple occasions this year, the federal government has stepped in to end work stoppages and force workers back on the job. This past summer, the federal government forced striking rail workers back on the job, and last week, they used the same strategy to end a work stoppage at two of Canada's largest ports. This behavior violates the charter right of workers to bargain with their employer. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers has experience with this anti-labor behavior as well, as the government passed back-to-work legislation the last time postal workers went on strike in 2018. Back-to-work legislation and other tactics by the federal government to end work stoppages violates the right to bargain and benefits wealthy employers. In national news, in an op-ed for Rabble, Anna Lipman explains the dangers of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism. The Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism would classify any sort of criticism of the State of Israel as anti-Semitic speech. Lipman explains that not only does this definition paint all Jews as supporters of Israel, but it also helps put Jews in danger. Lipman writes, quote, "Despite purporting to end the world's oldest hatred, this handbook harms Jews by conflating Jewish people and the State of Israel. With Israel committing a genocide in Gaza for nearly 400 days, associating me with this maniacal regime puts me at greater risk of experiencing harm in a society where people are rightly very upset at our government's inaction." End quote. Staying with national news, Fareed Khan explains in an article on Rabble that the election of Donald Trump does not bode well for tolerance in Canada. Trump is the type of far-right politician who has consistently sought to gain popularity by victimizing vulnerable populations, whether they be immigrants, so-called leftists, and the 2S LGBTQIA+ population. This is a strategy that far-right politicians have used for decades, with deadly results. In Canada, things are hardly different. Canada also has a far-right populist politician willing to victimize vulnerable populations to obtain power. In his speeches and media appearances, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre attacks many of the same groups that Trump is focused on. Whether or not the election of a far-right populist south of the border will be a boon or a bane for Poilievre remains to be seen. In environmental news, David Suzuki is calling for an end to the use of gas in homes, not just for cooking, but for heating as well. Suzuki explains that heat pumps are between 2 to 5 times more efficient at heating homes than gas heating, and heat pumps can be used to cool a home during warmer weather. In 2020, Vancouver took steps to encourage developers to move away from gas and instead use alternatives like heat pumps. Since the 2022 municipal election, however, the current council has moved away from this stance and started rolling back regulations on gas. Suzuki is calling on Vancouver City Council to vote no on a proposition later this month that would rescind the ban on gas on new home builds in the city. Staying in environmental news, Rabble columnist Kathy Crowe writes how municipalities refuse to accept that the climate crisis is making the national homelessness crisis that much more deadly. For years now, the City of Toronto has refused to open cooling centers during the hottest days of the summer so that those on the street can escape the heat. The city is already acknowledging that they do not have adequate facilities and resources to support the demand for shelter this winter. Making things worse, 12 Ontario mayors signed a letter earlier this fall calling on the Premier to use the Constitution's notwithstanding clause to suspend the charter rights of the unhoused so they can be evicted from encampments that they have made in public places to protect themselves from the elements. Crowe writes, quote, "Without adequate shelter, income, and housing, all forms of inclement weather hit unhoused people and poor people the hardest. There is no longer a day, week, or month free from danger." End quote. Staying with the issue of housing, in their first story for Rabble.ca, Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Eleanor Wand writes about tenants of a Bank Street neighborhood in Ottawa who are fighting being evicted from their homes by a wealthy developer. Over the weekend, residents living in the neighborhood around the intersection of Bank and Lisgar Streets gathered in Rockcliffe Park to serve demands to their landlord, the CEO of Smart Living Properties. The planned development includes 263 residential units, which are a mix of studio, one, two, and three-bedroom apartments. Many of the planned bachelor apartments are less than 300 square feet in size. The average rent in the city of Ottawa for the month of November is $2,040. Megan Smallwood, a member of the Neighborhood Organizing Center, a group of neighborhood organizers focused on tenant rights in Ottawa, said in an interview with Rabble, quote, "The main goal of the bank block tenants is that they all want to stay in their homes. So our main goal right now is really just to put enough pressure on Smart Living Properties directly so they back off and decide this isn't worth their time," end quote. And finally, how just is Canada's justice system? This is the question we pose on next week's Off the Hill political panel. Join us on Wednesday, November 20th, 2024, as we dive into this discussion with poet and activist Elle Jones, policy analyst Chuka Ejekam, and Rabble's own parliamentary reporter, Carl Nirenberg. Panel starts at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Register today with a link on rabble.ca to join us for this free panel. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to hear Rabble Radio on your local community or campus radio? It's easy. To learn more, get in touch with us today at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.